This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the Fox News Rundown Extra. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. We recently spoke with a technology ethicist who used to work at Google, Tristan Harris. He now runs the Center for Humane Technology. We spoke to him for our series, The Rise of AI, which aired last week. The fast-moving space has already seen a lot of change and major competition, as Microsoft, Google, and OpenAI all vie to have the best chatbots. But many, like Harris, say we may want to take a beat here. He explains, unlike previous technology, we actually know that a worst-case scenario involves AI becoming so much smarter than us that it somehow ends humanity. He discusses what regulation should seek to do for now, and the differences between regulating something like AI and social media. And yes, like others in this space, he says that involves international agreements. We often have to cut interviews down for time during the week, but thought you might like to hear this full interview. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Weekday Rundown podcast if you haven't already. Now, here's Tristan Harris on the Fox News Rundown Extra.
So just start by, we know it, but give us your name and title for the record, and we'll get all of our levels set.
Sure. I'm Tristan Harris and co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology and used to be a design ethicist at Google.
Okay, very good. I just want to start by asking you about the godfather of AI, right? He left Google, as you've done before yourself. And it sounds like he's saying he regrets what he's done in part. And now he wants to warn everybody about what he sees as the dangers of AI. And he specifically said, because some aspects of it seem to be smarter than we are. Maybe not in totality, but some parts of it. It feels like the beginning of that movie. So I have to ask, you know, are we too late or are we almost too late and there's still time?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I have to believe that we are almost too late. There are still things that we can do. Did we completely contain nuclear weapons? No, there have been several that have run loose, but we did collectively limit it to 9 countries. We did create the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. We did create a film called, you know, The Day After in the 1980s that gave the Soviet Union and the United States a shared view of the existential risk of nuclear war. And those things with regard to nuclear technology, I think, are important because they point to, you know, you could have been sitting here in 1945, and you could have Oppenheimer and Richard Feynman and Enrico Fermi and some of the atomic scientists saying, you know, we regret the creation that we made with the atomic bomb, and we don't see a way this is going to end well. And some of the nuclear scientists committed suicide, believing that they wouldn't be able to contain it. Mm-hmm. And yet we are here. We're still here right now. But we're not here because of just fortune and luck, although there is some of that. We're also here because a lot of people worked really hard to figure out, how do we deal with this new kind of power? Can we steward this power without destroying ourselves? And I think what you're finding, and there's this big letter that came out, you know, a month ago, the pause letter for AI. And, you know, some people, they anchored that to Elon Musk because he was one of the signatories, although he joined later in that process. Important to note about that letter is it's the founders of the field of artificial intelligence. Jeffrey Hinton just left Google, as you said, who's kind of one of the fathers of neural networks. But Yoshua Bengio, who's one of the fathers of deep learning, and Stuart Russell, who wrote the textbook on artificial intelligence, and, you know, Jan Tallon, the co-founder of Skype, and who's been funding research on AI safety for more than a decade. These people all signed this letter because they say that there are major existential risks here. And if there's that many credible people who literally created this field, I think it's very important that we have a very clear-eyed debate about, and discussion really, about what is of existential risk here. And if it is a suicide race, and no one wants that, literally no one wants our, you know, everyone to just disappear from getting this wrong. There's not a single person who wants that. So if that's not what we want, how do we coordinate? And just like we did for the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, just like we did for containing nuclear weapons and having the International Atomic Energy Agency. So I think that's what we have to do.
On the business side, when you see the race among the tech companies, right, and you hear about also some of the tech world's layoffs. Microsoft let go, what, an entire ethics team? Maybe not everybody in ethics, but certainly quite a few people.
Yep.
As we talk and we put the burden on Congress when it comes to regulations, what burden should be on the tech companies? You just referenced several people in the tech world who are calling for a stop. But when you look at the companies that are sort of pushing this and racing against each other and yep. laying people off as they do it, what is the burden in your mind on them?
Well, I think a lot of people inside the companies feel trapped because, as you said, there's now a market race to release, right? And when OpenAI and Sam Altman, you know, fired the starting gun and said, we are going to ship this as part of ChatGPT and ship it to the world. And it's important for listeners to know that it took 4.5 years for Facebook to reach 100 million users. It took TikTok 9 months to reach 100 million users. It took ChatGPT less than 2 months to reach 100 million users. So the rate in which we are deploying this technology is faster than anything of this kind of consequence. And moreover, we're not just sort of putting up a website and saying, here's this blinking cursor of this AI you can talk to. OpenAI, for example, has created an API, a platform that basically developers can include ChatGPT directly into all of their products. So you're seeing Snapchat integrate, you know, a ChatGPT agent directly to your 13-year-olds. And they're not testing this, right? And this isn't because they're evil CEOs or bad people. It's because the speed at which the clock rate of this industry has been set by market forces, and specifically by a handful of decisions about a year ago that said, hey, we're going to start releasing this stuff to the public. It's important to note that Google and DeepMind, for example, have very sophisticated advanced AI capabilities that they have been holding back because they don't feel like they're safe or ready for society to have yet. And that was a wise thing to do. That's the world that we should be living in. And I think what's happened is that now the companies are caught in this race that really was sort of accelerated by OpenAI's, one can say reckless, decision to release this stuff as fast as possible. Now, they'll push back on that and say, you know, we had GPT-4, for example, that we were testing for safety for more than 8 months. They had GPT-4 ready to release for 8 months and they held it back. And we should celebrate that they did that. And that's the negative space that we can't see, is everybody who is holding back their capabilities. But overall, now that it's released, now that it's out there, we are seeing all the gloves come off and all the companies are now racing to push this out there as fast as possible. So now when I talk to people who are inside the companies, they don't want that. In fact, they feel deeply uncomfortable that we cannot at this pace get this right. Think about social media. You know, social media is a relatively simple technology. It was their first contact with AI because it was an AI pointed at your brain. It's a machine that's calculating what's that next video or that social post or that tweet to show you when you scroll. Because it's not just showing you a linear set of here's all your tweets. It has to calculate with an AI which is the tweet to show you that will keep you scrolling, which is the video I should show you on TikTok that'll keep you on here the longest. And that was a very, very simple technology. And think about just how simple this and small the misalignment there is with society, that led to the shortening of attention spans, the breakdown of teenage mental health, the unraveling of shared reality because everyone's getting their own personalized, extremified view of reality, the outrageification of politics, the election of less and less sort of competent, I would say, officials and more outrage economy entrepreneurs as our representatives. And when you have that happening on all sides, right, that kind of distorts the public sphere that we need to have a working democracy. And if that was happening with AI because social media was moving too fast, because we didn't do the safety testing, because we didn't say, how do we know this is actually compatible with a working democratic society? If we're releasing AI a million times faster, or I should say, a few times faster, multiple times faster, and as a field, AI is progressing way faster than social media because they're pumping out accelerating capabilities that are jumping up, up and up and up on a super linear curve, meaning, not in a linear speed. And this is why Jeff Hinton, kind of one of the godfathers of AI who just left Google, left, as he said, it's not about what the capabilities are right now. It's the speed and the curve, the exponential curve at which these things are going. So we can still have that conversation and say, what do we want as a society? And it's totally a nonpartisan thing. It's just, what do we want to make sure that we as a humanity make it through this?
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI. It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I want to ask you about regulation. One of our recent Fox News polls found, and I'll read it here, that most voters, 76%, want some regulation on AI, but 59% yeah. don't think the government is up to the task.
Yes.
You know, to that end, if we're looking to the government to do this, and the stakes are different, right? And they haven't been able to come up with regulations on social media, as you yeah. know, you've seen all the hearings, right?
That's right.
Are the stakes different enough that this time is different and the pressure is different? And if China doesn't agree to the same set of regulations, or any adversary doesn't agree to the same set of regulations, how do we regulate our own use of AI to still remain competitive?
So these are some great questions. There's a few that you just laid out here. So I want to take them kind of one by one. One is around, as you said, we have not regulated social media. We're now 10 years into the crisis around how it's warped our politics and broken mental health and shortened attention spans and not been healthy for our democracy. And yet we haven't done anything. Now, why haven't we done something? Now, we would argue, as being people who've been working on that issue for more than a decade, that we waited until too late, until social media became entangled with politics, with journalism, with media, with television, with advertising, with how small, medium-sized businesses reach customers and advertise. The only way to reach customers if you're a small, medium-sized business is to use Facebook or Google or Twitter advertising, right? And so we waited until social media became irrevocably entangled with our society. And once it became entangled, think about how hard it is to ban TikTok, this is an easy choice. This is a Chinese Communist Party influenced company who's basically running the telecommunications infrastructure and Saturday morning cartoons of its number one geopolitical adversary. It would be like letting the Soviet Union run television programming for the US during the Cold War. You would never let yourself do that. And, you know, that's an easy choice to do. But one of the reasons it's hard is think about how many Americans are addicted to TikTok and feel like it would be a violation of their free speech, or feel like it would be, you know, whatever. And so one of the things that is different, to your point with AI, is that it is not yet entangled. And this is actually why we, you know, raced to create this presentation called The AI Dilemma, that I do recommend for as many of your listeners who are capable of watching it. Just Google for AI Dilemma. We really put it together in a way to say, look, we're at the moment before entanglement. Not everything in our society is entangled with these new artificial general intelligence, OpenAI, ChatGPT type language models. It's not embedded in everything yet. And if we're going to regulate it, we have to do it now, not after. And to your point, I think that does, you know, because the issues are more existential visibly than the social media ones were. We had to make the case for 10 years in the film like The Social Dilemma to have people even see and really acknowledge the risks of social media. One thing to note is that the people who built AGI, these artificial general intelligence companies like DeepMind, OpenAI, and Google, the people who started these companies, they would have been aware of the existential risks of AI since the very beginning. Unlike social media, where Mark Zuckerberg didn't say, now, if we build this, this might ruin society and democracy. He didn't have that thought. But literally every single one of the AI company CEOs have known about the fact that there are existential risks for humanity since the beginning. So we should at least acknowledge that there's some hope there. Now, to your second point, can the government regulate this effectively? Now, we might have the public will to do something, which is great, by the way, but can we actually do it effectively? Now, I would say that we are definitely behind, right? And it's actually important to note that, as far as I understand, the Chinese administration for the Cyberspace Administration of China, the CAC, is the largest regulatory body in China. I think it's personally helmed by Xi Jinping. And I think what that speaks to is that China views, and the Chinese Communist Party views, regulation of technology as one of the most important things that they need to get right. And they staff their regulatory body accordingly with you know, hundreds of people that are working there and working on it.
Wait, so is that good? is that good for global agreement?
Well, maybe. You know, maybe that what that means is that there's an ability to coordinate. Now, let's be honest. China is racing to AGI as fast as possible. They have said that. They do not view the U.S. in cooperative terms, in terms of AI. I think that's a mistake for both parties. The U.S. is similarly racing to AGI as fast as possible. But the question is, if you're racing to a technology that you and the people who build it don't believe you can control, as I mentioned in this AI Dilemma presentation, there's a survey of about 700 AI researchers. That was the largest survey that we know that's been done to date on this, asking people, what is the chance that humanity goes extinct or similarly disempowered from our inability to control AI? And 50% of the researchers, half of the researchers, said there's a 10% or greater chance that we go extinct from our inability to control AI. Now, that'd be like getting on a plane where 50% of the people who made that 737 you're about to board say, you know, there's a 10% chance that our inability to control this plane means that it goes down. So that's a number that we should have a democratic conversation, say we shouldn't onboard humanity onto that plane. Now, that doesn't mean that China's plane is safer either, by the way, right? Yeah. It's not like their plane is also magically a lot safer. This is a fundamentally uncontrollable technology of large language models. I won't go into the details, but basically it's a, you know, you build these things based on ingesting a lot of language. And for example, in China, they have not released large language models to the public because they're hard to control. For example, if you ask them about Tiananmen Square, they'll happily spit out answers that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't like. And so for that reason, China has been aggressively regulating this class of AI based on large language, because they see it as uncontrollable and dangerous. It's not really good for state control. Now, does that mean that they're still not racing to build AGI? They still are. But what we need to do is have a shared view of the collective risk here. I wish that there was a film called The Day After for AI that would be shown to everyone in the Chinese Communist Party, at the very least, if moreover, the citizenry, I think, as well, and everyone in the United States, so we could have a shared view of the risks here. And see that we're better off cooperating to get to something than we are competing. Now, I know that might sound incredibly naive to anybody, especially with a national security background. And believe me, we actually talk to people in national security and take those concerns incredibly seriously. But I think we have to be incredibly clear-eyed about the risks here. Because, you know, if I was China, I would see the United States racing to AGI right now and deploying it everywhere as actually unsafe for the entire world. Because it's not about the race to, you know, get plutonium. It's about the race to harness plutonium in a safe way and not have loose fissile material that anybody can build weapons with. And right now we're releasing AI in a way that is sort of, in the US at least, that is racing to deploy plutonium to everybody as fast as possible, but not actually having the safety controls. And I think the race isn't to get to AGI, the race is to harness AI safely. And we should both countries really agree on that.
Just a couple more for you. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy set up some panels for lawmakers of both parties, as you know, with two AI experts from MIT. That seems on its face like a pretty good idea, right? If you're going to regulate this thing and you're going to have the conversation, you should probably hear from some real experts, some real computer scientists. What else would you tell lawmakers to do or read or watch other than, you know, the AI dilemma of your own production?
Well, I think, yeah. And by the way, there's no self-promotional aspect here. In fact, we didn't even care. We weren't trying to get into this space. It was actually people inside the AGI, artificial general intelligence companies, that actually came to us saying, this is happening at a pace that's not safe. Will you please help with your public platform, create some awareness about it? So I really want people to know that. I have no interest in getting extra attention on any of these issues. I think it's great that Kevin McCarthy convened, you know, these AI tech leaders to brief lawmakers. What I worry about is who's in the room. I worry about just because you have a computer science background or a technical background or an AI background does not mean you understand the interaction effects with society. I found this with social media, right? I met some of the smartest people I'd ever met in the world at Google and at Facebook and at these, you know, YouTube, at these companies building these advanced systems. And what I think there's a bias that when you meet really smart people, that they're therefore going to know, on the engineering side, that they're going to know suddenly how it's going to affect teenagers 10 years from now. Or they're going to create, you know, a dozen extremist movements or the breakdown of politics and open societies. You know, just because you understand the technology doesn't mean you understand the interaction effects with society. And there's a different class of experts, people who study, science and technology studies, sociology and psychology and, you know, all these sort of, you know, critical media theory. And those are the kinds of disciplines that I think we need here. And I do think that people should really look to the experience of social media. Here's this very simple thing that has many benefits. It creates all these efficiencies. We can suddenly see everything that's going on in the world. And we just got it wrong. It's not intrinsic to social media that it would unravel society and democracy. It was that the incentives and the race that it was designed against, which is to get maximum engagement, to get attention, which means shorter bite-sized forms of attention, more extreme, you know, political takes, cynical views on everything go more viral than good faith interpretations of what people are doing. And that was enough to unravel society. And that had to do with social psychological effects of a technology on society. And what I want for lawmakers is to be briefed by people who are really focusing on the interaction effects with society and the ways that it can cause existential risks. So I don't think that that McCarthy meeting had as many of those people. And we are certainly trying to brief lawmakers as much as possible. And we want the whole world who has those skills to be briefing lawmakers around the world. And I worry that this is happening too fast for our institutions to deal with. And we have a very short time window if you think about how fast this field moves compared to other fields.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Finally, Tristan, we've had kind of more of an existential conversation thus far, but my last question for you is, if we're going to use it, if it's going to be here, if we find a way to corral it, harness it, and everybody sort of agrees that we're going to use this thing, right? We're going to try and make things easier, better, whatever. If it's used in like medicine or loans or applications for things or even just basic historical questions, and it's consuming information from the internet, it's consuming information and analyzing data that we're giving it, how do we make sure it's not biased? Especially if, as you've said, it can be wrong, it can hallucinate, right? So are there still, even existential questions aside, things that we need to focus on in the here and now in terms of making it as unbiased as it can be? And is that even possible given that it's learning from us?
Yeah, I think the concern about bias is incredibly important. Can we make it unbiased? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, is ingesting and reading the entire internet beyond the scope of any number of human moderators? It'd be like saying, I want to moderate every single one of your 10-year-old's thoughts. It's like your 10-year-old has a million thoughts about a million things, and you don't know how the 10-year-old's going to respond when it sees some new situation. These are fundamentally uncontrolled technologies, and the people who built them say they're developing capabilities that we didn't program into them, and we can't even predict what those capabilities will be. Can you govern something that doesn't have a control mechanism? That's actually one of the deep concerns about the risks, is that if we don't understand how it's acting or why it's acting certain ways, what does it mean to have the ability to govern, regulate, or control it? Yes, we do need to worry about bias. Yes, we do need to worry about these things hallucinating. And there are many benefits, just to say, of these technologies, to your point. So we're steelmanning that for a second. You know, these things can create efficiencies to program things faster than any human being could ever program. I could say, hey, I want a website of an Uber for dog walking, and, you know, make it design with a purple interface and write the code for it. And it'll actually create the website, create the designs for it, write the code for it, and then let me just run it. And instantly, I don't even have to be a programmer. That's an incredible set of efficiencies. But just as easily as I can have it do that, I can say, write code to talk to TaskRabbit, go find all the extremists in your country and go hook it up to a wallet, and let me pay and incentivize the darkest people in your population to do the dangerous, most dangerous things. That's all just using language. When society runs on language, I can manipulate your society at scale with misinformation and target the most vulnerable and extreme people. And at the same time, you have social media that is radicalizing and alienating people and feeling more lonely, the burn it all down, incel, angry folks sitting at home. That's not a safe world that we want to unleash these technologies within. So the challenge with AI is the inseparability from the very thing that makes it give us these benefits, which is the ability to automate language, the language of code, the language of messages, the language of emails, the language of, whatever, or even voices or video are also forms of language. The more it can automate those things, that has amazing benefits, but it can also be used on the same side of the coin, or really the other side of the coin, to influence your population at scale. And one of the examples we've mentioned in terms of making it accessible to the average person, the recent techniques, I can take 3 seconds of audio of your voice. I could call you up and not say something and say, hello for 5 seconds, and I get you 3 seconds of your audio. And then I just captured your voice into a little parrot. Now I turn around and I call your bank, or I call your mother and say, hey mom, I forgot my social security number. I'm filling out an application for something. And do you remember what it is? Or do you remember where I was born? When was that street again? Right? And we were using this as an example in our AI dilemma talk, and it turned out that this has started happening. People were already starting to do this. So again, when I can simulate language, democracy runs on language. This country was argued into existence in text. You know, there's nowhere is it written that the printing press enabled our democracy to exist. But large language models and AI might be the very thing that disables our society and our democracy from existing. I'm not trying to be polemic. I just want people to really understand what risks we're dealing with here.
Terrifying. Well, Tristan Harris.
Well, this is why we're...
Yeah,
I was going to say thank you so much for having me. And you know, I'm here with you because I want the regulators and policymakers to recognize there's real existential threats here. There are people who understand this stuff and who are ready to help. I don't even care if it's me, right? I just want the people who know the most about this to be in the room with you where we can actually figure this out, you know, book a hotel room, lock ourselves in it, figure it out. We've done this before. Bretton Woods took, you know, delegates from hundreds of countries sitting in a room for 6 months to create a positive sum economic system, the world financial system. You know, we can try to create a world that actually works with this technology, but it takes an urgent coordination. So let's drop the infighting. Let's drop the partisanship. Let's just get it done.
I'll do a formal lockout with you now for the sake of our podcast. Tristan Harris, Center for Humane Technology, thank you so much for joining us.
So good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Really, really appreciate it. That was very scary, but I'm glad we talked.
I apologize, but I hope that, I hope it was balanced, right? Like I don't disagree with any of the benefits. They're amazing. They're unbelievable, right? But it's sort of like a deal with the devil, right? It's like, that's going to be the sweetest tasting apple I've ever tasted. But if there's no way to separate it from the other thing, you know, that's the challenge. So,
We'll stay on it. We'll be,
but there are ways to harness the goods. We will. Okay. Yeah. Please do.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for airing this and getting this out there. Okay. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.